Where does this workshop fit within what IEW, this system? Because you've been hearing about, oh, well, this is an expansion of Unit 7, or this works well with Unit whatever. It doesn't actually fit in the sequence. It's what you do after the sequence. So if you've been to Units 1 through 9 once or twice, then this is what you would do after. So it's really on the advanced track. I'm going to be talking about high school level. I've seen people do, especially a lot of the classical schools, do some of the things that I'm going to talk about well in middle school as well, maybe 7th, 8th grade. Not so much with 6th graders. They still lack some of the maturity. So the kinds of writing that a person would do in what I'm going to be talking about here is mostly journaling and literary analysis. And so it would be a student who has already learned all of the sentence openers, the dress-ups, the decorations, the triples, all of that, and can stop putting them in every paragraph. Okay, we've learned it. We've got the toolbox. It works well. And now it's a decision as to what I use, what tool I take out for my purpose. Purpose, purpose, purpose is a huge word for literary analysis. So it's kind of the next step. I was thinking about the power of literature. And what I was going to do originally when I thought about this topic is I was going to read you two excerpts from a book. You know, one really, really sad. I was going to make you cry. And one really, really funny. I was going to do the cry first, and then we're going to be happy. But the thing is that, you know, I really don't have time for it. So could you just believe me? You know, that literature has the power to move, to motivate, and to influence. It has the power to move us on a very deep level. And, you know, if you were in a class like this, and you read something, the last thing you would want to do is cry, I mean, in public. But you couldn't help it, because that's how powerful it is. You know, I mean, laughing, okay, yeah, we can laugh. That's socially acceptable. But, you know, Swedes don't cry, ever. I cry all the time. It has the power to influence us, both for evil and for good. And we don't even realize it at the time. And it has the power to motivate us, either to succumb to life's problems or to overcome life problems. So it's really, really powerful. I remember one time my daughter and I were in Washington, D.C., and we had brought Where the Red Fern Grows. She was, I think she was, how old was she? Middle school, maybe. I don't remember. And we, you know, we knew it had a sad ending. And so we were reading parts of it on the plane. We took this Greyhound bus tour to Jefferson's, Monticello. Yeah. Oh, sorry. But we didn't. You know, we knew it had a sad ending, so we quit. Two chapters to go because we weren't really sure. You know where it was going. Two chapters to go. We quit. And we came back to the hotel, and we propped up our pillows in bed, and my daughter went and got the Kleenex box from, she knows me so well, you know, and we read the end of Where the Red Ferns Grow, and there's, you know, I challenge you, you cannot read that without crying. It's just so moving. So, you know, and sometimes that kind of moving is good. The Greeks have a word for this. The word is catharsis. Mm-hmm. Catharsis. And it's kind of ironic because both really uplifting literature and really sad literature both have this, they can make us feel cleansed, to make us feel purged, drained of emotions, fulfilled, you know, vicariously living through someone else's eyes. And so, you know, that can be a good thing, but it can also be incredibly dangerous. Let me explain that. This is such a little tiny printing. I knew you wouldn't be able to read it all, so I reprinted it in your notes. This is actually how we learn, okay? We have various sources of input, okay? Authority, teachers and texts. This can also be revelation. You know, we believe something because somebody tells us it's true. Columbus came to America in 1492. How do you know that? Somebody told us, okay? Personal experience. I touch a hot stove, and boy, I end up with a burned finger. Okay, I'm not going to do that again. Feelings, intuition, and emotion. That's another way we learn. We don't really know why, but we just feel these things. Or cognitive logic and experience. You know, if A, then B. You know, so if I touch a hot stove and it hurt the first time, you know, and I'm near my fireplace, I'm not going to put my hand in because I've learned through logic that if a stove hurts, you know, the fire's going to hurt too. So, you know, various things that way we learn. Epistemology, I think, is the fancy word for this. Is that right? How we know what we know? How we know what we know. Okay. And then we filter that. We have filters. Personal background, our culture. Okay. So if I, you know, I'm Swedish. I grew up in a very small Midwestern town, and this is what we did. We did it because, I don't know, we just did it. Previous experience, our reasoning, and then the Holy Spirit, the Bible, our conscience. You know, we have these filters. So we take what we learn, we run it through these filters, and then that's how we learn. We take the input, we run it through these filters, and that's how we learn. But the problem is that a person can get their filters turned off very easily, okay? This happens a lot with movies. Especially movies in a theater in the dark. Hitler learned this, you know, the power of getting right to the person through using twilight and using a certain kind of lighting. And that's why he held all of his demonstrations at night. You know, he was a master at this kind of psychology. And with a movie, too, it comes at us all at once. We don't have time. You know, we can't hit that pause button and say, wait a minute, I need to think about this. You can't do that because it comes all at once. Well, literature is not quite like that, but still it can happen, you know, if we get really involved in something. This is coming right at us, and, you know, maybe we don't have our filters on. And so what we need to ask ourselves is how can we enjoy the beauty and the power and the message of literature without escaping its dangers? And even more importantly, how can we teach our children to do that, to enjoy but not be adversely affected? Well, I have two ideas, two suggestions that might help you. And one is exercising discernment in our choice of literature. Now, I'm going to warn you here that this is an area of controversy, and we might not agree, and that's totally fine, okay? But this is on the advanced track. This is students who are in high school, maybe, and preparing for life with their colleagues, life with college, life with life, their business associates. And so, you know, there's some things that I think we should do to prepare them. Now, when my children were really, really young, I was very careful about what, you know, literature I let enter the house. We never had a TV. One day my husband turned it off, put it in the car, took it over to his mom's house, and I never saw it again. And that was, so for about 25 years, we didn't have a TV, which at first was hard, but after a while, it's like, where did we find the time? So I sheltered. You know, I'm all into sheltering. But you know, my kids were like hothouse plants. So you gardeners, a hothouse plant, what happens if you take that hothouse plant and you put it out into your garden? It dies? Okay. Always? No? It might be damaged. Okay. So if it doesn't die, it might be damaged. Oh, you might get it to grow. Okay. More attention. Does it grow to its full? Might not. Okay. I don't garden. I shop. So, but, you know, I think the analogy really holds. The same thing can happen with our homeschooled, with our private schooled, with our Christian schooled, with our children. You know, if we take them from a very safe and very controlling, very sheltered environment, which I'm all for, but then just, you know, out to the real world, you know, I think there's a problem there. And so especially for the college student who goes from a Christian or a private or a homeschool English class to a college English class, oh, my word, Huge, huge difference. So basically there's two views on the topic of literature selection. One is to keep pure, upright, beautiful, godly literature all the way through high school, okay? And evil can never triumph in the book. The characters can't be too evil. No swearing. No, none of that kind of thing. And the other view, and this is actually the one I hold, is that I think that students need to encounter these situations while they are still under the direction of a caring and loving parent or teacher. And so a dampening off kind of period. And so a less sheltered environment. Okay, do you take World Magazine, any of you? Have you ever seen this before? I love this. And all the other ones. I just had to pick one. Okay, so here's this guy. You know, he looks pretty upright, you know, pretty, could be a Christian private or homeschooled student. And, you know, here's this other gal, you know, and you know what happens in college. And I can't read it. So here's what it says in the little tiny print. Where's your son getting his answers? It might be from a sweet girl like Julie. She's smart, pretty, and believes she's a reincarnated Babylonian princess. Now that's karma you don't get at home. You know, my children, all of them are in college or have been in college, and, you know, the stories I could tell you, oh my, the stories I could tell you. So, you know, the idea is to prepare our children to encounter life. And I think literature can do that. So I view my role as a high school English teacher, and before my role as a homeschool mom, to prepare my children to encounter life. So how do I do that? Well, first of all, I allow into my classrooms books that have swear words in them. Now, I know. Now, these are the kind of words that you would see in a PG-13 movie, not an R-rated, draw the line. Not no F-bombs. I don't want to hear about those at all. However, I do a couple of things. First of all, I have all of these words marked in my own book, and if any student doesn't want this, I offer to edit their books, black marker, you know, to white, black, I guess that would be black out, everything, you know, that they don't want to see. And it takes me, 10, 15 minutes, and if that is something that is a stumbling block, I have no problem doing that whatsoever, and I will. First, and then I never allow these words to be read out loud in class. So if we're reading a passage that has some swear words in it, you know, I don't want to hear them spoken aloud. I have this one student who has taken it upon himself to be the censor. And so, we're reading along, and he'll go, beep. And the other kids have gotten to the point where they wait for him, you know. So if he's not paying attention, it's like, you know, come on, let's do that. And then thirdly, I always talk about, at some point, I talk about what is the effect of this swearing? You know, how does it affect us? Are we more in, do we learn more about the author than we do about the situation? You know, why are they there? You know, what is the purpose? And that can be really an interesting discussion. Secondly, I allow some books that have some off-color scenes in them, but not purient ones. And this includes a lot of Shakespeare. I was shocked when I read the opening scene to Romeo and Juliet in a modern translation. I was like, oh, I didn't know that's what they were talking about. And so basically there's two men there that are telling some dirty jokes, off-color jokes. So how do I handle this? Well, I'm Swedish. I don't handle this. If the students want me to explain it, I just say, well, it's off-color, and, you know, I move on. We don't need to discuss that. And so that's, I don't really handle it. Then thirdly, I allow, and sometimes I welcome, some non-Christian and even some anti-Christian works of literature into my classroom. So they give me an opportunity to do a couple of things. One is that they give me the opportunity to discuss other views of the world. You know, because people. Me, I don't know about you, our students probably, they think that everybody thinks like them. But that's not so, of course. And so sometimes they help with that. Then they also give me the opportunity to preview what they might read in a book club, in a community book club, or talking with their neighbors, or in college, and, you know, to evaluate what they're going to hear, you know, and talk about that. And sometimes I've actually had students come to the Lord through this process. Not very often. I wish it were more. It's probably... Anyway, Lord of the Flies was the book. And when I heard I had to teach Lord of the Flies, I was not happy. When I really got into it, I was ecstatic. This is a wonderful book for what I'm talking about here. And this student was confronted with his sin nature for the first time ever. And he, you know, he listened to the gospel message, and he became a Christian. The book itself talks about, you know, human nature, and the author doesn't have any answers, you know, or his answers. I don't think his answers are very good ones. But, you know, we talked about, you know, the nature of man. Yeah, that actually was pretty correct, but, you know, we have better solutions. So finally, I exercise some discernment, too. I tend to stick with the older, the works of classics, the ones with literary merit. But I know that in literature courses, you know, sometimes they need, you know, sometimes somebody, your administrator, if you're working towards an exam like the advanced placement English and composition exam, sometimes you want to have modern ones in there too. So this year, for the first time in my AP literature class, we're going to be doing The Kite Runner. Have any of you read this, The Kite Runner? Okay, it's got a very problematic scene in it. It's a male-on-male attack, and it's integral to the whole book. And when I heard about that, I didn't want to read it. I didn't want to read the book, but I was assured that it wasn't prurient, that, you know, it was, you know, done as tastefully as possible. If that seems like an oxymoron. And it's a very powerful book, and we're going to give it a try. And so I think that, you know, it gives us a chance to talk about topics such as friendship, redemption, you know, recovering from past problems. And so the scene's not graphic, and I think this is a good choice. I might, depending on the class, you really have to know your students. Depending on the students, I might teach Barbara Kingsolver's The Poisonwood Bible. Have you any read that? The Poisonwood Bible. Nobody? Okay. It's really a few of you. Okay. It's really not a good book. Okay, it's about this minister who goes to the 1960s era Congo as a missionary to preach Christianity to the people of the Congo. However, this man is arrogant. He wants everybody to be just like him. You know, he's not even a Christian. You know, when you read the book, he's not. And so the narrative voice in this book is split between the wife and the four daughters. So each one takes a chapter, and you never really hear the point of view of the minister himself, but you hear it, you know, you have the point of view split. And it's really, I think it would be really an interesting book to talk about Barbara Kingsolver and what her view of Christianity is, because it's not Christian. And that could lead to larger questions about, you know, well, why do people think this way, and what do I think? Then there's books like Beloved, Toni Morrison's Beloved. Anybody read that?
Yes.
I'm not reading that. I'm just not going to. It's got some very graphic, very violent scenes, you know, against women and children. And, you know, I don't want that in my brain. I don't want those images in my brain. There's nothing that I can do about this situation. It's something that happened, you know, a long time ago. Do I need to know about it? Well, yes. You know, do I need to have it? Do I need to learn about it through literature? I don't think so. So, but you know, in college, the college that my kids went to, freshman English classes, that is the book of choice. And so one of the things that they did is they picked their freshman English class based on the text that would be taught in that class. They voted with their feet in a way. So to wrap up, basically what I'm trying to, you know, let me say one more thing. Since I teach in a classroom now, if there's ever a situation where a parent objects to a book I have selected, and that could happen this year because I've selected one that's really on the edge, and you know, I'm thinking, even now as I'm thinking, do I really want to do that? I haven't really decided. I'll meet my students. I'm not scheduled to teach the book until spring till the spring, and so I'll meet my students and then I'll decide. But if the parent objects, it's out of here, you know, because the parent has the final say. And if the parent doesn't like it, after I've explained why I chose it, how I'm going to approach it, what I hope to do with it, if the parent still doesn't like it, it's out of here. No questions asked. I will have a substitute. No problem. So let's talk then about this word literary merit. Okay, we want the students to read quality literature, works of literary merit. What does that mean? Well, it's kind of hard to define in words. It's easier to define with examples. Pride and Prejudice is a work of literary merit. Harry Potter is not. Books by, well, Melville, we were just talking about, Hawthorne, Dickens. These are works of literary merit. Works by Nicholas Sparks are not. Okay? Let's see. Nicholas Sparks, The Wedding, Something About a Day.
The Notebook.
The Notebook. That's what it was, The Notebook, not The Wedding. Okay, so when we're talking about literary merit, you know, there's all sorts of lists that will include works of literary merit or books that are part of the great conversation, okay? And, you know, every book is different. Every list is different. And I have one for you. I provided a link to a Google document on your handout. This is the works of literary merit prepared by the College Board. These are the people who sponsor the AP English Literature examinations. This is what they think as works of literary merit. Yes?
Oh, no,
I'm sorry. Oh. That's my kids, too. Don't twitch when Mrs. Myers is up there. She might call on you. Okay. So, you know, and I don't think I agree with the College Board's list so much, because a lot of the times what they want to do is they want to put in some modern literature, and so you'll have a title that shows up once or twice and then, you know, goes away because it just didn't make it. The Kite Runner could fall into that category. It showed up on last year's list and this year's list, and we'll see if it shows up again. So I want to take a little detour here and talk about AP. What is that? Okay. AP stands for Advanced Placement, and it is now trademarked. You cannot use the designation AP, Advanced Placement, unless you send your course syllabus through an audit process. It's such a big pain, but that's what you do. So it's there's two English Advanced Placement exams. And one of them is the English language and composition. It's basically nonfiction. And I'm going to be talking about that side of English tomorrow. And the other one is the English literature and composition exam. And it's a three-hour test. It's offered one day in May. You can take it on the day in May or not. You only get that day. Well, I think there's a makeup day. And so it's 3 hours. It's two parts. One part is an hour of multiple choice, 60 multiple. There's four passages, and then about 10 to 15 questions after. These are really hard. Like, they give you this passage to read, and then in lines 15 through 20, what is the shift in perspective of the speaker? You know, what is the tone of this passage most like? It's really hard. Of a person who gets 50% of the questions correct on the multiple choice and does about 50% on the essays as well will pass the exam with a 3. You can earn between a 1 and a 5 on the exam. And then it depends on the college. Some colleges will accept these exams for college credit. Some won't. And it also depends on your major. If you're a major in English, they probably wouldn't. The English literature and composition exam is equivalent to 2 quarters worth of college credit. And the language one, the one tomorrow, I'm going to mention it tomorrow, is worth 1 quarter. So the two together could give a student 3 quarters a year of college English credit. Okay, so the questions then, there's 3 questions, and the students have 2 hours to write 3 essay questions. I don't think I could do this. And they're rough drafts, of course. One is a poetry analysis, so they give you two poems, actually, lately it's been that way, and you have to compare the two. One is a prose analysis where there's a passage, and then you have to say how the speaker, the author, makes meaning from this passage. What is, you know, oh, that makes me feel so sad. How does it do that? You're analyzing it. And then the third one is the open question, and it's last year it was about foils. A foil is a character who is a minor character who shows off characteristics of the main character. Okay, so if the main character, if the foil says, you know, let's just do it, who's going to know? And the main character goes, well, I would know, and that's not right. You know, then you know something about the main character through the actions of the foil. So the question was, pick a major piece of literature in which the foil acted in a way, I can't remember the exact wording of the question, but so then the students would have to look in their brain all these works of literary merit that they have picked, you know, that's where the list comes, the works of, because there's some suggestion on the exam, and then answer the question based on that. So I gave you also on your handout, I gave you the works that I'm teaching, and the one that's iffy is Catch 22. I'm not, you know, I go, yeah, I need to teach this. It's biting satire. But it's got an anti-hero in it. There's no redeeming characteristics. But then I'm thinking, oh, do I really want to do this? So I haven't decided. So, you know, that one is, but the rest of them I think that you would be okay with. Ender's Game is not, that's what I teach to my college prep kids, not my not the advanced track, the regular track, and it has a lot of swearing in it. So when I go through and edit that book, it takes me a little longer. But it has some great questions. You know, do the ends justify the means? You know, is man a tool? You know, what is the nature of man? It really, really good things. Plus, that book is the book I have students. I'm very sorry to say. I have students that have gotten to their senior year of college and passed all of their English classes without reading the books. I don't know how they do that, but, you know, they're not passing my class without reading the books. And so by the time they get to Ender's Game, it's the first book they really like. And so, you know, I think that has something to, that, you know, that's helpful too. So, all right, this is one way of looking at high school as an overview. And some of this stuff could be done in middle school at will. It really depends on your children. Okay, so in ninth grade is really a catch-up year. You know, some of the things that were not quite done in eighth grade have to be handled because, you know, that foundation has to be built there. So that would be essay writing, close reading, mechanics. You know, grammar should be done. You know, by the time you get to high school, the grammar issue should be done, unless you teach students whose first language is not English, and then you're, that is with you always. 10th grade is where you'll be doing what I'm talking about here, where you're understanding the elements of literature. That actually starts in 6th grade, and this is a good place to just put that to rest. And then from there, you're reading books and applying that. The schools that are doing both of the AP language and literature, usually they do language in 11th grade and literature in 12th. But this, you know, a lot of schools don't even do the language. And I think that's too bad, because when I did go to graduate school, this is the kind of writing I was doing. So, but a lot of English it's all literature all the time. And so, you know, that nonfiction element isn't in there. So this is one way to organize high school classes, certainly not the only way, but just one. Okay, the question of the seminar is, how do we think? Okay, you know, I love it when this all works together, because that's the next thing that I want to talk to you about. We've talked about, you know, what kind of literature, and now I want to switch and talk about how to approach literature. And the one thing we need to do above all else is actively think about what we're reading. And so, you know, it can't be like, you know, I read Harry Potter. I waited till they all came out and went on Wikipedia to find out if Harry died. And when I found out he didn't, I said, okay, I'll read these books. It took me like 15 minutes to get through all of them. It's not really. But, you know, I mean, it's like there wasn't anything there, and I'll never read them again because, you know, there wasn't anything there. Passive reading. You know, it just came in. If I missed a couple of things, no big deal because, you know, it was just enjoyable reading sometimes. And so what we need to do is we need to activate those filters and think. So how do we think? Well, in high school, one of the, and in middle school too, some other, but especially by high school, one of the ways that we could do it is through a process called annotation. Annotation is basically writing in the book. Now, homeschool parents, Christian, you know, if you have to buy your books at all, homeschool parents, private or Christian school parents, they don't want their kids doing this. Why? Exactly. They want to resell them. But the thing is that this is the key to literary analysis, is thinking as you go along. And, you know, sometimes my kids will tell me, Mrs. Myers, you know, I read this, and I got to the end, and I just didn't get it. Well, it's because they didn't stop and ask questions along the way. And so I want to demonstrate this, and as I thought, I would be running out of time, so I actually have annotated this already. This is a passage from Fahrenheit 451, and this is one of the works of literature that I teach to my college prep. It's actually, I think it's on the AP Literary Merit, too. So it would, okay, this is the beginning. It's either the first chapter or the pre-chapter. It was right at the beginning of the book. So this is the first sentence. It was a pleasure to burn. Now, with annotation, you stop and you think, okay, and you write in your book. So I would say, pleasure? Really? And then burn what? You know, it's a pleasure to burn. Burn what? Okay? It was a special pleasure. Oh, boy, look at that, same word. So it was a special pleasure to see things eaten, blackened, and changed. All right, with the brass nozzle in his fist, with this great... look at that. With this great python spitting its venomous kerosene upon the world, the blood pounded in his head and his hands were the hands of some amazing conductor playing all the symphonies of blazing and burning to bring down the tattered and charcoaled ruins of history. Okay. Long sentence, I have lots of questions. Why does the hose have kerosene in it? Don't hoses normally have water in it? I'm reading this, I'm thinking, wow, that is a really powerful image. I can really see that. His. Who? Is this some kind of a criminal? You know, a pyromaniac? You know, who is this guy? And I'm looking at the word hands that's repeated here. I'm wondering why that's the case. And then I'm looking at this ruins of history. Is the idea here to destroy history? What's with this? With his symbolic helmet numbered 451 on his stolid head and his eyes all orange flame with the thought of what came next, he flicked the igniter and the hose jumped up in a gorging fire that burned the evening sky red and yellow and black. He's burning a house. He's burning a house. This is not a good man. Okay, why is he wearing a helmet? Oh, boy, I can't even read this. What does that say? Oh, why does it say 451? And that's in the title, Fahrenheit 451. My kids all call this Fahrenheit 911. Fahrenheit 451. What's with this Fahrenheit 451? Why is he wearing a helmet? Is it some kind of a uniform? Don't say it yet. Shh. He strode in a swarm of fireflies. Okay. I'm from Minnesota. I was born and raised in Minnesota. I've been out here for 30-some years, but I remember those fireflies. And I remember those campfires when they were burned up, the sparks, they looked like the fireflies. So like Minnesota camping. He wanted, above all, like the old joke, to shove a marshmallow on a stick in the furnace while the flapping pigeon wing books died on the porch and the lawn of the house. This man's burning books, okay? And he's equating it to like a very pleasurable experience, like roasting marshmallows over a campfire. While the books went up in sparkling whirls and blew away on the wind, blew away on a wind turned dark with burning. Okay, either that's a fragment or I made a mistake when I typed it, but either way, books. Okay, and is this, what does this say? Is this
how he destroys history?
Is this how he destroys history? Okay. Could I have the lights back on again? So this goes on for another paragraph, which I won't go into. But the idea here is to stop and think. Stop and think. Annotation, the key to literary analysis. Now, the thing is the kids don't like this. They don't want to stop and do this. And so I insist. I teach this with short stories first, because in a book, now in a book, I probably wouldn't do this much in my own book, you know, because you only have so much room in the margins, you can't do it. But I teach it with short stories. Actually, you have to write in the book. And where I teach, grades are a huge motivator. So I grade it. I have a 10-point rubric that I use to grade the annotations. The kids say that slows them down, and I say, yep, good. That's what I want. I want you to slow down, and I want you to think. And they want to enjoy the book, and I say, yeah, so do I. But I want you to enjoy it on a deeper level. And so so sometimes, you know, I'm lucky to get my college prep students to read the book once, but I require my AP students to read it twice. And so they read it once for effect, you know, like I've got some personal reactions here, okay? The author wanted me to have those personal reactions, okay? This is a book about, it's a future book, dystopia. It's a dystopian novel about a society that does not have books. First of all, it decided not to have them, and then they became illegal, and so the firemen, instead of burning houses because saving houses that, you know, catch on fire, they don't do that because they're all fireproof. The firemen burn books. They ferret out and burn books. They're the thought police. And so so what to annotate? Well, you know, there could be anything. Vocabulary definitions. On the next page, it talks about the fireman looking at himself as a minstrel man. Well, what is that? It's the old blackface, you know, performers. So, you know, there might be vocabulary words to look up. There might be, you know, questions that you have. Why is this man burning? Do you know why it's Fahrenheit 451? A little louder.
That's the temperature at which paper catches on fire.
It burns.
Okay, so book burning at Fahrenheit 451. So questions about that. Connections with other parts of the book. In the introduction here, it introduces the hands motif, the hands. Montag, who is the protagonist, finds his hands doing things that, oh, look what my hands are doing. He's disconnected from himself. He's undergoing a change. And so, you know, some connections. If you find something that's repeated over and over, ask yourself why that is. Possible symbols, you know, some really, really well-crafted sentences that are just really cool, you know. All right, there is an essay by a man named Mortimer Adler. Is that on your handout?
Yes.
It's really worth looking up on the internet. You'll find it in many, many different places. And he wrote an essay called How to Mark a Book. That is a very good one because it gives more on the subject of annotation. So things that touch me, things that appall me, things that... I connect with some part in my life, anything, okay, any, you know, something that has, oh boy, here's the theme, you know, sometimes the theme is hard to find, but you find a passage, that's got to be it, you know, so anything like that. And then another way to help the kids annotate is to give them some questions to begin with. So I know a lot of teachers will give an essay question after the book has already been written, after the book has already been read. I don't do that. I give my essay questions up front, you know, and then it's another connection there. It gives some more, you know, things to look for. So Odysseus, when he went into the Cyclops cave, Cyclops is like this huge monster with huge footprints, and Odysseus stayed there, you know, was that an act of rashness? Or was that wise? You know, why did he do that? In Antigone, nobody mourns the death of this girl. Why? Why is nobody sad when she dies? If Gatsby had married Daisy, if they married, would they be happy? You know, that's a really good thing to think about. Does fate control our lives? Lots and lots of books on with the theme of fate running through it. Does fate control our lives? So these are things, you know, at the beginning especially, these are things that you might want to have your kids think about. Then, another way, so here's one way of annotating writing in the books. What if you have a library book, or you have a mom who's just certain that you can't write in the book because you have to save this for the next several children. Then what do you do? Well, here's another way that I found that works. It's called a dialectical journal. Okay, I'm going to move that so it can't. Okay, so this is what you do here. This is what the text says, and this is what I say. So it's a way of thinking about the text. So a twinkle, twinkle, little star. A good way to describe the blinking of a star, the repetition reinforces the action. How I wonder what you are. The speaker seems interested in the nature of a star. What is it about stars that seem to fascinate us? It's hard to imagine that the starlight we've seen has traveled 1,000 years in space. Okay, so the first one, we've got some literary things, repetition. The second one, we've got a connection to something that the person's wondering about. Like a diamond. How are diamonds and stars alike? Okay, good thing to ask questions. Better to attempt an answer. Attempt an answer. And so I tell the kids, if you knew the answer, what would it be? Okay? So, well, I'm not really sure, but maybe it's. And then it opens up a whole, you know, new level of thinking. They're both shiny diamonds. Well, no, I won't. Yes, I will. Diamonds are precious and found in the earth. Stars are precious, too, because of their beauty and unattainably like Estella in Great Expectations. So this is a text to another text connection there. So we've got lots of questioning going on there. Dialectical journals. So quotes from the text on one side and what you think, question connections on the other. One of the things that you want to do is you want to teach your children the tools and techniques of literature, okay? How does the author do that? And I start out, when I do this, I also teach an introduction to cinematography class. And in cinematography, it's a lot easier. Kids are really into movies. And it's a lot easier to see. There's three big tools that the director has. There's light, there's color, there's music. And sometimes I play the introduction to Jaws. Have you seen this movie, Jaws? Okay, so I turn the sound off and I play the introduction to Jaws, and it's basically, you don't know it yet, but it's from the shark's perspective of swimming through the water. And so the first time I play that through with Pachelbel's cannon, okay, and you know it's like, oh, this is going to be just a really elegant movie, you know, maybe a documentary about ocean life, and it's just, you know, beautiful, beautiful words. And then the next one I play it through with a children's song that I got off of my, you know, We Sing, you know, something. And it's like, you know, somebody likes We Sing. Okay, and so, oh, this is going to be bright and lovely, you know, a day at the beach, you know, this is going to be really, and then I turn it on with the real music. Bum, 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 bum. Okay, I was wrong. This is not going to be such a good movie. And it's just that one tool that the cinematographer used has created a mood, okay? And the same thing happens in literature. The way that the author crafts his or her sentences creates impressions in our brain. So I want to demonstrate this to you with a passage from Lord of the Flies. Now, here's the thing. If you have read this book, you have to put everything you know about the book out of your mind or this won't work, okay? So the only thing you can look at is this passage. That's it, okay? So this is a book about a group of boys, British boys, who are escaping from England in an unnamed war, a Third World War, being evacuated to somewhere in the Pacific. And they crash land. Their plane crashes on an island, and all of the adults die. They're the only ones there. So they're from about 4 to about 12, okay? And so the first thing that they do is they go about exploring the island. They find a rock, and, you know, what are they going to do? They're boys. They're going to push it over the cliff. And so that's what they do here. So this is what it says. Okay. The great rock loitered, poised on one toe, decided not to return, moved through the air, fell, struck, turned over, leapt droning through the air, and smashed a deep hole in the canopy of the forest. Echoes and birds flew. White and pink dust floated. The forest farther down shook as with the passage of an enraged monster. And then the island was still. Wacko, like a bomb! Wee-ya-oo! Not for 5 minutes could they drag themselves away from this triumph, but they left at last. Okay. What is your impression of the island? I'm sorry. That's next. Without naming any literary devices, okay, what is your impression of the boys and their situation here? What words come to mind? Yes?
Wild.
Wild, okay.
Boys.
Okay. Boys, okay.
Fun.
Okay.
Living in the moment.
Living in the moment. Very existential. Excitement. Adventure and chaotic. All right, now, why? Why do you feel that way? Why do you feel that this is triumphant, typical, living in the moment, fun, you know, boys will be boys? Why do you feel that way? Well, okay, the gal who said apprehensive said that's why, okay? She feels a little apprehensive because of the enraged monster, okay? But let's look at the rest of the passage. Is there anything else that would make you feel apprehensive? Yes.
Well, I wasn't thinking of it.
Carry on.
Well, I was just going to say that first sentence. I mean, look at all that list of verbs. I mean, just, you know, it's describing the action of that rock moment by moment, second by second.
Yeah.
Given human characteristics, how can a rock
What poises on one toe? What poises on one toe?
A ballerina,
okay? So the great rock loitered, poised on one toe. Is this, you know, is this scary?
Precarious.
You know, not for ballerinas. You know, moved, fell, struck, turned over, leapt, droning through the air, smashed a deep hole, okay? It's following the rhythm of the rock itself. I mean, you can actually picture that rock going through, okay? Then there's a pause right here, okay? Echoes and birds flew. There's a phrase of the comma, slows us down. White and pink dust floated. Again, it slows us down. The forest farther down shook as with the passage of an enraged monster. Ooh, maybe a little bit of foreshadowing there. Colon makes us stop and take a breath, and then the island was still. All right, let's look at this one. Same beginning of the book, the boys have figured out how to make fire by taking someone's glasses and setting, of course that wouldn't work with our glasses now, or maybe they would, but they've made a fire. The fire has blown out of control and it's gone down the side of the mountain on the other side of where they've landed. And this describes the fire. The flames, as though they were a kind of wildlife, crept as a jaguar creeps on its belly toward a line of birch-like saplings that fledged an outcrop of the pink rock. They flapped at the first of the trees, and the branches grew a brief foliage of fire. The heart of flame leapt nimbly across the gap between the trees and then went swinging and flaring along the whole row of them. Beneath the capering boys, a quarter of a mile square of the forest was savage with smoke and flame. The separate noises of the fire merged into a drum roll that seemed to shake the mountain. How does this make you feel? What's your reaction to this passage? Fear, right? Danger. Dangerously beautiful. Ooh. Oh, cool, good. Out of control. This is exactly what you want to do when you're analyzing literature. You want to look at the passage and then you want to say, How did the author do that? How did the author do that? Well, we've talked about capered, the connotation of the word capered. What else? Crept as a jaguar creeps on its belly. This is not a good thing. Okay. All right. Branches grew a brief foliage of fire. Flame leapt nimbly across the gap. Okay, flaring. Okay, so you're looking at what the passage... Could I have the lights back on, please? What the passage does, and then how does it do that? How does it do that to you? And that is the basic of what analysis is. And that's why annotation and dialectical journals and questions are so important. And so what you want to do is you want to build a new toolbox for your children, okay? You have the sentence openers, the dress-ups, the decorations. Now you want to build a new one that kind of expands on that, and that is the art of literary analysis. And so how do you do that? And so very humbly, I would like to offer my book. This is actually, I wrote this for my 10th grade honor students to do just this. What it does is it takes and it teaches the foundations of literary analysis. So it goes through the literary elements that the students have probably already been introduced to at some times: plot, characters, theme, point of view. What's the last one? Setting. Okay. But then it talks about how those all go together. What other techniques? Anaphora. That's basically a triple. Okay. So you're learning new language for some of the techniques you've already learned, but, you know, going on them. Symbolism, how does that all work? How does that get together? Irony, humor, how do these techniques work? And then some of the ones that, you know, I won't say these big, huge words because that will just make you feel nervous. But the idea here is to get a course foundation. And then, after the student has learned these principles, to apply them to anything that he or she reads. Okay, to build upon that, to enjoy literature, and to move on. What I do is first I do like I did with you, and I show how this all works, and then I add the labels, okay, the literary terms for this, you know, like simile, which they already have known. But, you know, you teach them what a simile is first, and then and its effect, and then you apply the label. And on your handout, there are some other websites. Virtual Salt and Dr. Wheeler are fabulous, fabulous sites for literary terms. And you know what else is a really good one? Is Wikipedia. Wikipedia, you know, is for people who have a lot of time in their hands and want to share it. And so that's also a really good one, you know, to teach the literary terms. So you get the term, an example, and how it works, and then look for it in the piece of literature and see how that works for you. And let me just leave you with one thought, and that is the theme of the convention. We want to have our children think. We want to have our children think about things that are worthwhile, and literature is a fabulous way to do that. Not the only way, but a fabulous way. So thank you so much. You were a fabulous audience, so thank you for that.